This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
As the fighting rages on in parts of Sudan, our humanitarian operations in the country are virtually impossible at a time when a third of the country is in desperate need of assistance.
That was Brenda Karuki, the World Food Program's Senior Regional Communication Officer in Eastern Africa, on the agency's decision to temporarily suspend its operations in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, the bodies of 41 drowned migrants have been recovered from waters of Tunisia. And the head of a military force created to restore peace in the eastern DRC has resigned, citing death threats. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. AU Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki Mahamat yesterday reiterated his call for the Sudanese Army and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF paramilitary, to immediately agree on a permanent ceasefire and to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance to Sudanese in need. Multiple attempts at a truce since the fighting began on April 15th have fallen apart. Will the African Union's recent call for a ceasefire make any difference? That is the question I posed to Professor Elliot Masote of Devere University.
Yeah, the role of the African Union really is to look into such conflicts in Sudan really before they happened, because conflicts within those two generals have been going on, and the United States, the European Union, sat down with those generals, and they agreed on an agreement to work together. So the African Union, I don't know where it was, and really coming at this point in time with only words when people are suffering, it's definitely not enough. So, but then we cannot say it's too late and nothing can happen at this point in time. We need to take all parties involved, even the United Nations, the EU, the Arab League, the African Union, because, if such things happen, it affects the whole region, it affects the whole continent, it affects the whole world, because we're going to have refugees. Because Sudan is for the Sudanese, Sudan is for all Africans, and then Sudan is for the whole world.
In talking about Sudan, we're dealing with two elements here, Professor. Mr. Faki reiterated his call on the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces to immediately agree on a permanent ceasefire. We are dealing with two individuals. How do you approach this? How can you make sense to these two individuals?
I will approach it in the sense of putting across consequences for not listening to the African Union, for not listening to the United Nations, because just telling somebody that you have to do this without consequences of not doing it, they are not going to stop. They're not going to stop. And this conflict, it has some history in it. It has some history in it, and we're coming a little too late. But I think one thing that can work is, sanctions to be immediately imposed, and then the threat of some type of force to these two generals, that if you are not going to agree on a ceasefire right now, a permanent ceasefire right now, this is going to happen. And then an example must be set. An example must be set so that nothing like that will ever happen again. Because, for these two generals, I don't see them giving in, because of the mistrust between the two of them. So to some extent, I think force should be imposed on these two, generals, just to stop whatever they are doing and talk.
The AU very recently actually negotiated a peace treatment between Tigray forces and the Ethiopian government.
Exactly. That's what I was saying. I think the African Union negotiators should be somewhere close to Sudan, maybe in Chad or in Ethiopia, trying to make these generals get out of Sudan to meet somewhere and talk. Okay. Because the war that is going on, nobody is going to win in a war. those generals should understand that. The African Union should understand that nobody will ever win in a war, because you win, but look at the destruction going on. Mm-hmm. Look at the suffering that is going on. So, you know, whoever is going to win, what did you win after killing people? What do you win after destroying the whole country, or, you know, making even the world suffer economically, and all those refugees there? So I think the generals really don't understand that concept, that you would never win anything by keeping on fighting in your own country. Nobody will ever win.
That was Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devery University. He talked with me from the U.S. state of Ohio. Sudan's powerful neighbor to the north is watching its conflict with deep concern, but Egypt seems unable to take a clear position. Egypt is close to one of the two sides in the fighting, Sudan's army leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. President Sisi said Egypt would not take sides in the conflict and offered to mediate. Experts say a weak regime in Khartoum, or the emergence of an alternative political order that is hostile to Cairo, could have serious repercussions for Egypt. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, explained the reasons behind Egypt's lack of action in Sudan to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
The Sudanese conflict is more of a global conflict rather than bilateral Egyptian-Sudanese struggle. Factions in any country going through civil wars, international sanctions, power struggles often turn to foreign patrons for assistance. Sudan is no exception. Even before the fall of the weak al-Bashir regime, it began seeking foreign boost by playing off great and regional power games in the ongoing second Cold War between the West on the one hand and China and Russia on the other. They offered the Russians a logistic base in post-Sudan while reaching out to Washington to lift decades-long American sanctions for terrorism-related issues by normalizing relations with Israel. Egypt was not happy with these games that would bring global cold warriors into the area. Egypt similarly was not happy with Libyan General Haftar bringing the Russian Wagner to the internal struggle. For the same reason, it was not happy either to see the Sudanese leaders bringing Wagner into the Sudanese territory. These local players in both Libya and Sudan internationalized the problem and weakened the Egyptian influence vis-a-vis this regional and international powers. So this also made Egypt, which has its own unprecedented current economic crisis, unable to meddle into this internationalized involvement in Sudan. For Egypt, since the independence of Sudan in 1956, the new state in Sudan was very fragile and could not control the country and had the longest civil wars and biggest number of coups in Africa. So naturally, Cairo realistically sided with the Sudanese military as the only major power holder in the third largest state in Africa.
If the conflict continues, millions of Sudanese would escape to Egypt. Egypt already hosts an estimated 5 million Sudanese. How serious is that scenario for Egypt?
This conflict can be a black hole for economically strained Egypt. That's why Egypt was one of the first countries to offer, along with South Sudan, a ceasefire. Now, if it continues, many Sudanese refugees would come to Egypt, and it is not known if the EU or the UN would offer any financial compensation to Egypt. This would also weaken Egyptian-Sudanese position toward the Ethiopian Jert. The Sudanese crisis with a weak central government would create haven for terrorist organizations in the Horn of Africa, from the Somali Shabab to other jihadist organizations who may also try to reach Egypt and other neighbors. Egypt has signed agreement with Sudan, the four liberties that allowed Sudanese nationals to come and work in and stay in Egypt. And that's why it is not very easy for Egypt to block Sudanese refugees from coming to Egypt.
Former Foreign Minister Nabil Fahmy said ultimately Egypt wants to see stability, security, and sustainability for the Sudanese, which serves Egypt's national interests. But stability has often been used as a pretext for authoritarian regimes to suppress dissent. Why do the Sudanese political class fear the Egyptian backing of Abdel Fattah al-Burhan?
Many African states and developing countries have authoritarian political systems. Why? The mere huge geographic size of Sudan, the third largest now in Africa, is a multi-ethnic tribal society. Controlling it since independence required a strong central government found mainly in the military, while many revolutions in Sudan succeed in toppling the regime and destabilize the country, they could not provide a strong, stable government. Some Sudanese intellectuals scapegoat Egypt for the existing authoritarian political system, which is no different from those that exist in many neighboring African countries with similar problems that explode every now and then with revolutions and civil wars like Ethiopia. Egypt doesn't back General al-Burhan per se, but the realistic power that can control the huge land of Sudan, the National Army. Until a strong force emerges in Sudan and can impose law and order, the Egyptian government cannot back militia or some intellectuals here and there who cannot manage and control the country. The problem is not the Egyptian government, but the nature of the Sudanese state and society.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Citing security concerns, the World Food Program says it's been forced to temporarily suspend its humanitarian operations in Sudan, which already had food shortages before the current conflict erupted 2 weeks ago. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
WFP says around 15 million people, a third of Sudan's population, already face hunger. With evacuations underway, millions more are dealing with food shortages inside the country and in neighboring South Sudan, where thousands of South Sudanese refugees are fleeing for safety. Brenda Kariuki is WFP's senior regional communication officer in Eastern Africa. She says WFP had planned to assist 7.6 million Sudanese this year, but she says those plans have been shelved for now because of concerns for the safety of WFP staff.
As the fighting rages on in parts of Sudan, our humanitarian operations in the country are virtually impossible at a time when a third of the country is in desperate need of assistance. We are hearing of acute shortages of food, water, fuel, medicines, and access to healthcare. With this crisis, we are afraid that millions more will plunge into hunger.
The crisis has triggered a huge displacement crisis, with thousands of Sudanese and South Sudanese refugees fleeing to neighboring countries seeking safety and protection. The United Nations reports some 20,000 people have fled to Chad, and at least 4,000 South Sudanese refugees have been returning to their homes of origin in five northern states bordering Sudan. Kariuki says these numbers are expected to increase as the crisis escalates. She notes WFP will be unable to provide aid to needy people inside Sudan as long as the current situation of insecurity persists.
WFP staff, offices and vehicles and equipment and foodstuffs have come in the direct line of fire, and looting of our warehouses continues. To date, we know up to 4,000 metric tons of food meant for vulnerable people has been looted from our warehouses, and at least 10 vehicles and 6 trucks which transport food have been stolen.
She calls this unacceptable, as it takes away humanitarian aid meant for the most vulnerable Sudanese and refugees who desperately need this life-saving food. Among those most in need of humanitarian aid, she says, are the hundreds of thousands of refugees who are sheltering in Sudan, school children who will miss out on their daily meal, malnourished infants, and pregnant and breastfeeding mothers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. The French news agency AFP reports the commander of the East African Regional Military Force, created to restore peace in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, has resigned, citing threats to his life. The volatile, mineral-rich region along the border with Uganda has been racked by increasing violence involving rebel militias that have ensnared neighboring countries. Kenyan General Jeff Nyanga, who has led the East African Community Force drawing on troops from Burundi, Kenya, Uganda, and South Sudan since November, said he was leaving the mission due to aggravated threat to his safety. Nyaga said there was a well-orchestrated and financed negative media campaign targeting him that aimed to frustrate the efforts of the regional force, created last year to stop M23 rebels who seized swaths of territory. The East African Community Force is operating in areas it says have been liberated from the militia. But many locals are disappointed the force is not taking the fight directly to the rebels and say the M23 continues to operate with impunity. In Cameroon, hundreds of singers are using their voices to call for a ceasefire between the military and separatist forces in restive western regions. The separatist conflict has killed thousands of people from and displaced 750,000 since 2017. Mokidwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
This song, Stop the Crisis, by Cameroonian singer Zenat Brenda, was sung live in Yaoundé by scores of singers who converged to join their voices and sing for peace. In the courtyard of the Yaoundé City Council, the singers performed songs calling for an end to the killing and destruction of property in the restive northwest and southwest regions. Among the several hundred civilians listening to the singers is Jeronie Bitam, a 24-year-old university student. Bitam says the songs speak to the conscience of Cameroonians who live in fear and uncertainty.
C'est une musique qui est fille de son temps, avec des artistes qui...
He says the peace singers are pulling crowds because their music includes traditional rhythms from all the regions of Cameroon. He says all the songs he has listened to can be appealing to people of all generations and of different social, cultural, religious and professional backgrounds. Similar events organized by Cameroonian Artists for Peace will take place in towns and villages across the Central African state, the organizers say. In the songs, the artists ask communities in safer localities to accommodate displaced persons. They also request fighters and government troops in conflict areas to observe a ceasefire so peace can return. The singers say they will not travel to towns and villages prone to regular separatist attacks. They say singers and choral groups in western towns and villages where clashes are ongoing should sing in public squares when possible. Ate Francis is the board chair of the Cameroon Musical Arts Corporation, SONACAM. He says the singers are tired of the bloodshed, rape, maiming, stealing, and abduction for ransom in the two western regions where separatist forces are fighting to set up an English-speaking state. He says SONACAM assisted the artists in their peace caravan.
These songs that call for peace and reconciliation are released by artists who are expressing concerns of the suffering of the people and hoping to touch hearts. When you sing, we could consider that as some form of release of tension within the artists themselves who are living and suffering with the people and decide to put it in song, hoping to touch the hearts of the government and the boys who are fighting in the bushes to sit down and talk and solve this problem, which is bringing untold suffering to our people.
The large-scale appeal for peace by singers in Cameroon is the first since separatist crisis degenerated to an armed conflict in the Central African state in 2017. The peace singers say they rely on personal contributions and assistance from well-wishers to organize the musical peace caravans. The governors of Cameroon's restive northwest and southwest regions say they support all efforts to restore peace, but insist that fighters who do not surrender and drop their weapons will be killed. Separatists also say they support the initiative, but fighters will continue their struggle for self-determination. The separatist conflict broke out in 2016 when Anglophone Cameroonians protested what they said was discrimination by the Francophone majority. The UN says fighting has since killed at least 3,500 people and displaced at least 750,000. The singers are performing songs in both English and French, hoping to appeal to both sides of the conflict. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Snake experts in South Africa say an energy crisis is partly to blame for a shortage of anti-venom in sub-Saharan Africa that has left at least three people dead in the past 3 weeks. South Africa supplies anti-venom to the region, but frequent power cuts have made it harder to store the refrigerated supplies. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
Bjorn Unger is the owner of the reptile garden. He's been working with venomous snakes for the past 24 years and hasn't been bitten once. And right now he's praying his luck doesn't run out, because thanks to a power shortage, he has no anti-venom. Handling the yellow snake, he says they come in many different colours.
They are extremely problematic, the Cape Cobra and the Black Mamba, in that they're extremely potent venom. They're responsible for most fatal snake bites in South Africa. But we do also get a lot of bites from the puff adders and the Mozambique spitters.
Alan Heath was recently bitten by a Cape Cobra in Noordhoek, Cape Town. He's lived to tell the tale thanks to local snake catcher Stephen Megan, who knew where there was a stash of anti-venom. The two local hospitals Heath initially was taken to didn't have any.
I was walking the dogs, and the first thing I noticed, I just had a sharp pain in my left ankle, and I looked down and the snake was actually attached to it. So I just grabbed it and threw it away.
Megan says it's a miracle Heath survived. In sub-Saharan Africa, as many as 20,000 people die a year, according to the World Health Organization, an admitted underestimate. Megan says the snake community has been battling to get answers about the shortage from government officials since it started a year ago and is affecting the entire sub-Saharan region. Another snake catcher, Arno Nudia, is part of the National Snake Bite Advisory Group, which includes top medical professionals. They've written to government officials appealing for urgent help.
Recently now in southern Africa, in Eswatini, which used to be Swaziland, we've had three people that have died as a result of not being able to get anti-venom, as well as we're losing dogs on a daily basis.
Nodia says certain government hospitals have no anti-venom, while others don't have sufficient supplies for adequate treatment of even one venomous snake bite.
Yes, we can pull them through with maybe 6 or 8 vials, but they're probably going to have kidney damage. They probably lose tissue on part of their skin. They may have an amputation.
In response to VOA's questions, the National Health Laboratory Services says production levels of anti-venom should be adequate by the end of May. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
Coast guards have retrieved the bodies of 41 drowned migrants from the waters of Tunisia, a senior National Guard official told Reuters today. The bodies were in a decomposed state, suggesting they had been in the water for several days. Reuters says the cumulative total of fatalities was unprecedented over such a short period. Numbers of boats carrying migrants, most from sub-Saharan Africa, Syria and Sudan, trying to reach Italy from Tunisia, have risen sharply in recent months, in part due to a crackdown on departures by authorities in neighboring Libya. Tunisia is struggling to contain the surge, and some morgues are running out of space to bury the victims. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokabilia Baro, and our engineer, Kelly Williams, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.